Please be seated. Tonight, we're welcoming the poet Jonathan Wells, who will read to us from his volume of poems, Train Dance, which was released last year. Unlike most poetry readings elsewhere, as is our custom, this one will be followed by discussion in the conversation room about poems and poetry. Mr. Wells' poems have appeared in The New Yorker, Paris Review Daily, Poetry International, Alaska Quarterly Review, and many other publications. He was recently nominated for the Pushcart Prize, and I just learned something I should have known. He is a Johnny. Please welcome Mr. Wells.
Thank you, Dean Krause. The fact that I went here was unknown until a few moments ago, so that got lost in the translation. I want to read poems in two groups. I want to read some from my book, which was published last year, which were written over a 10-year time period. And then after that, I'd like to read some more recent ones. These poems follow a very cursory chronological journey, and but it's mostly a journey of digressions, not a strict itinerary. The first poem is called The Dream Line. In my bottomless bed, I am driving the lamp side of the river to the station, past the dog run and the Tudor town hall. The streets wax slick with rain are ready for hoodlums in leather to spook them. Commuter on the dream line, I can trace seven streams with my fingertip into the estuary bottom through unfigured air where the river spreads its fingers into the sound. An innocent skull rose, 16 knees and elbows, a fraction of a centipede going slow. I wait there, and the train plunges through me in unscheduled truth rattling. I can choose my seat by the rain-stained window and fit a magazine to my face. But no matter how far I lean into those turns, I cannot catch tomorrow's train tonight. This is a poem called Alexander's Library, and I think of it in context of being a student here, because it never occurred to me until I was a senior that parallel lines met, and it stuck with me. Alexander's Library. I dreamed I saw Alexander's Library the night I slept in the Alexandropolis station with War and Peace as my pillow, 500 miles too far north, waiting for the train to Istanbul. I was the boy orphaned on such an afternoon who wandered to the ceremony too numb to feel the kite strings coiled tighten on his whitened finger. My kite could soar higher than all the wisdom in the scrolls my father had once commanded me to study. The believers and the satirists, historians of the early wars, even higher than the minds of the stars' geometers. All those who claimed to live closer to the gods with their bickering and mastery I could surpass. I watched the pageant, but I was numb to its colors, the silver threads in the ladies' skirts, their daughters holding pinwheels up to the shingled light as the young boys ran alongside with tinsel. Smoke drifted from the harbor in the animal shapes of clouds, tinted the pink my grandmother painted on her cheek, and the emperor, his eyes still sharp from the foundry, watched the horses mimicking steps and the scribes as they measured the bites from their figs. My kite glided through the sky higher than the monument, roofless and silent, and I released it between the tapered pillars that nearly touched in that upper heaven where parallel lines meet. A lot of my poems start with something I read in the paper or wonderings, and I not that constructively try and follow them and see where they go, and usually they don't go very far. But I started reading the horoscopes not because I wanted to know what my fate was, but I just thought, well, what would a poet's horoscope be like? I mean, would it be a prediction of language? Would it be in what way would it be a sense of the future? So I wrote this poem to answer my own question, or try and answer my own question. The poet's horoscope. You will awaken this morning as flushed as her steaming body stepping from bathwater, as full as the blossoms on the crabapple tree, each bud globed in a bulb of water, a raindrop sustained. A golden retriever will lead you back from your battle to a garden you've never visited before, that you know flower by flower, gangs of ferns, a high forehead of stone, the owl's woodwind question. You will stand there apart in grace in a footbath of moonlight. Small incidents will nudge you from your sleep tonight. The raccoon's eyes flashing like reflectors without a body. Black tea leaves leafing again in boiled water, turned a living brown and green. The day will pay you in dollars for words that survive the night, the ones that disturb you, hang above your eyes like bats, make you turn on the lamp and reach for your water glass, swelling the brain like a river gathering more and more rain. The words you repeat until the meaning warps. You will guard them as you sit shrinking at your desk, poet, paper thin and paper filled, palpating the painted wall for its water pipes. In these rooms, flecks of paint will be your only color. In your next life, you will be a builder of reservoirs and dams and sleep with your dowsing stick. In your next life, you will be patient and tall. In your next life, you will hardly care for words at all. Patterns of sleep. America falls asleep from east to west, toppling like whole forests in an ice storm. Some children are seized in their last syllable, others are conquered by a book. In the hall, a single lamp holds its vigil, the moonbeam is a post of light. At the coasts, the oceans toss and turn, brushing the tangled beach with regular strokes. Inland fields of corn sway like sea fans in a trace of water. The mountains bewitch and stupefy the body, deserts spin the brain to sand. I defend the citadel of sleep as the world's force assaults me with messages and mail, the rains of heaven and local rain, dawn sketched freehand between the terraces and rooftops until the sun swells up over the threshold like a Sunday paper thick with news. The book is divided into four sections. And I barely remember now what I was thinking when I did the division. First group were really fantasias, where I did what I described before, where I just imagined something happening in a different context. I've always been very interested in music, and the Growing up as a kid in the suburbs, going into the city on the train represented a chance to hear music in a way that I couldn't where I was growing up. So a lot of these are musically oriented and also related to the relationship between the suburbs and the city, and the train which took you back and forth, and the train which also takes you back and forth to the past, the places you visited. This is called the Tailor's Song. If I could cut my own cloth with my own pinking shears, so it fell just so, harmonious across the shoulders, sweeping from the seat to the knees, melodious in the sleeves, verses flowering like handkerchiefs, then I could carry myself like a tune into the chorus of the city. Morning gamblers. They look through me as if I had not lived yet in my shapeless suit, my unwrinkled shirt. I pass them in the gambling car, which rocks to a syncopated beat, tilts the cardboard table on their knees, their ties flung back as though a real wind had stolen in to frisk them. Slaves and enemies of chance, the dice their only eyes, the window smudges winter. Luck streams in blind, and blindness multiplies the towns along the river into a blend of platforms, mummers' faces, and signal towers. I take my backward-facing seat far down the aisle. The naked beech trees knit a fence to keep time and chance away until I take my ticket and slip it back into the lottery of the city. London plane, and as will become obvious, it's not an airplane, it's a plane tree. When I'm alone, the tree I love whispers and calls to me, indifferent to the season. I come to her in spring when she's in bud, and winter when she's naked, only one side warm. In fall, she forgets herself and dreams. I come to her for learning and read her bark like braille. Her arms are twisted, lifted for attention, glassed in rain or wrapped in mist or gray. She speaks from her own wisdom, not always prompted by the wind. I come without ideas of love, for she is already rough and rounded, cankered, tall, and we are not alone. Finches listen from her branches, and plastic bags luff, confiding my desire in the wind. The tree I love lowers me from my window ledge, equal to her height. She says, "Sit close to me. When I call to you, what loneliness makes you listen?" The title poem of the collection needs a little bit of explaining. It's called, as the volume is, Train Dance. And I used to go to the train station when we lived in the suburbs and pick people up. And as a grown-up, I did this with my younger son. And I liked to get places early. I don't know if that's because I think something good is going to happen. Usually at a train station, nothing good is going to happen. But my son would get very bored. He was 6 or 7 years old. So one day I said, "Well, why don't we dance? And why don't we start dancing? And you know, maybe if we dance, the train will come sooner." So as kids do, they look at their parents with dismissively, to say the least. So I realized that I had to start, and so that's the background for the poem. Train dance. At the boarded up station, the trains arrive in fits like manna from a city of feasts. My son and I wait for them on the platform and start to sway to encourage them from the distance. At first, he moves slowly, doubtful that any prayer will make that gray face appear from the isolations of fog and light like lava. I say to him, if you won't dance too, the train won't come, to help him with his hesitation. So, released from any shame of recognition, we dance like crazy minstrels, fingers snapping, heels and toes bouncing off the glittering concrete, grinning with our eyes closed like monkeys handling gold. Our dance of faith gathers speed, like the train itself leaving its original station, as though we were tuned to the same internal station. An accelerating salsa, slow in the waist, amid the throwing of arms and legs until it stops before us. The doors split open and still jangling, we take our seats, bound for plenty. As a poet, you exploit what's around you. And since I have four kids, I exploit them. This is called The Last Summer Night. After my son wraps his shoes in tissue and packs them in his case to go, the cat's crying splits the darkness into strips of silence, and the house loses its other music. Rooms lose their furniture without a sound. Paintings are erased from the walls like lights being switched off, and the ceiling lifts into the star's cathedral. The groping, oceanic night smudges all lines with its black arms and legs, and so she won't disturb your dreams that the thin air makes wild. The cat weeps again for him who will never quite return. What I hear through tears. Your back is the wall I cry behind. I started writing poems when I was a kid, and my introduction to poems came about because growing up in the suburbs, when my mother picked us up after school, she used to have on the Dylan Thomas tapes. And so I listened to these tapes, not knowing who he was, where he was from, why she was listening, for years. And the cadence of them, the sound of the words got stuck in my head. And I at first I didn't try and resist, then I tried to resist for a long time, and then I gave up and stopped resisting. This is called Dylan Thomas Stopped in Ossining. Even 13, riding the station wagon's axle bump like a surfboard in the curl of the hills through the housing clusters, my hair straight on the felt roof. His every word arose in me as a dove awakening in a magician's hand from the miracle of thin air. On what Welsh planet in a cottage did his kiss ring against the glass like a tuning fork that reverberated in my suburb as the cassette's chocolate-colored tape unleashed so many feet of language, language retrained like a lapdog who slowly learns to hunt and lust. Mother drove us past the Dewdrop Inn as his tongue marinated in richer whiskey liquored on. The metallic fog hovering over the Hudson River, no match for the cobwebs of Swansea Bay, our modest conversation pale next to his livid mastery. As the tape replayed his plaintive tricks, our car windows sealed against the flood of other noise, so nothing would restrain that tune in me. And with no other witness but myself, I believe, wavering, she carried it too through the patchwork of the hills. It is his deeper singing I remember, and the adjectives he added to his fear to give it the best direction. His fears masked hers and made them orderly, like two lanes of traffic merged in one neat caravan of cars. A visit. My brother sleeps upstairs on an inflatable mattress. That air was once my breath. There won't be time before he leaves at dawn to recall the grape stand under the stars near Kandahar, or our friend Joe, emerald smuggler, or green beret, seized at the border with Iran, shouting, "I'm a Christian," as he was led away by guards to the barbed wire enclosure. If my brother crashes on the floor, his dreams porous, awakened now, will he remember the elements I haven't chosen? Even asleep, he offers comfort without color. He is still here, but unconscious, and gone but conscious. How will we live again that clear wood smoke evening? A summer squall leaves few traces on the lake, a little air still in the sails, an extra wrinkle in the waves. One life. One life is long enough. Please don't ask for days or months, or wait until the bottom of the page to visit the doves she named for you, the bed she kept made for you, her hair that grew into your head, her hush that passed your lips. One life is long enough to remember what you have forgotten, the attic swings laughing on their chains, shoe prints on the ceiling, scrimshaw shadows, the pine trees scratched into the wall's back when the branches shook, the lantern in the dock blinking off and on, as somber now as a beehive in winter, all the things you couldn't pack. One life is long enough to know what you've forgotten and will forget again. The Russian mowers who came on Saturdays and taught you to say, "Do svidaniya," goodbye. I only wrote one poem. Most books of poems these days need a theme or only get published with a theme. And I was the last person to know what my theme was. I didn't really understand that I was a train freak. And yet, by reading the poems over and over and over again, I realized there were trains in them, which I couldn't explain. So it seemed like the obvious direction of the book. And I really only wrote one poem to amplify that. It's called Graffiti. Our wall ran as long as a freight train, with over 100 cars of rolling stock, and kept rushing. We wrote with spray cans, markers, smoke and gas, flowers and roots, species of trees, hummingbirds, eggs, and seed. We used all the languages, parts of speech, symbol, likenesses, and punctuation. The light was shed from galaxies and candelabra, flashlights, diodes, temple lamps, tapered bulbs, and crystals. Every letter was statuesque, every scratch an epitaph. The Giving Position. The poems gave me a house, a boat, two rivers, and a meadow. My mother, my father, sister, and brothers weaving back across an ocean, a lake, a pond. They gave me fish that didn't blink, acres of swallowing grasses, some tables of the tides, and the long, slow highway outside. The gifts appeared at dusk in my living room window, hid in the grist of night, or I dreamed them and shed them where the river splashed my feet, walking on its stones or squatting in the hills. Day by day, I pay them back. Because the book's poems cover a very broad period of time, they have very diverse voices as I was finding my direction. This is probably the most recent poem in the book, and it's important because often what I'm dealing with in one of the sections is the connection between writing and memory, how memory is defined by writing, how writing is defined by memory. And I find that with each poem that I write, that I can locate exactly where I was and when I was and what was going on around me when that line came to me. So all these lines for me have a context, which obviously they wouldn't for you. But so that's when I started to think about this, how for me as a writer, it comes to define memory in perhaps less superficially than how a photograph defines memory. This is called The Hill 1 Year Later. I wrote myself back into the ceremony of ashes on the hillside of sliding winter leaves and sand cherry bushes. A triangle, a chime, a few notes played on a flute by a child, the naming of plants, phrases worthless to the air, wind without direction. The hill rose and sank inside my chest. Each verb took me closer with its pale breath to this being, the hill's silhouettes of motion, the life's elaborate agitation. Each adjective tiptoed in the half-light to the window, groping for a shadow. The hill moved me in two directions. It shrouded me and I broke through it. I rose against it and I shrank. It towered over me and plateaued. Coming was not leaving. There were two sides to every feeling. Please hold. I am a telephone ringing in midair, a chair pushed back from the dining room table after a long conversation. Speak to me again. Say my name. The rice, cold, not close, still marries the bride and groom. The holster fires like a gun. The reins of the cottonwood trees go slack, and the field lays down on itself. Bird songs overlap their notes in the fluttering. I am hungry for the earth, aren't you? Come to me, say my name. The sun made me 10 stories tall when I walked in the lines of the labyrinth keeper's rake. One story made me wiser than I am, and I could feel the geese fly out of me, although they barely moved their wings. Say my name. The dressing room mirror revealed 3 lives in that face, but she saw only 2. The horse and child mattered to her. The other life was mine. Is that call for me? Please hold, I'm coming. I was walking through LaGuardia and I saw a cop bronze bust of some person who, no idea who he was, maybe it was Fiorella LaGuardia for all I knew. And I thought, you know, that's interesting. And that's what made me think about my monument or lack of a monument. This is called The Well. When I die, please name a well for me, a well plumbed in rock, the smell of water on my loved one's lips, who I loved from too far away. Tell her the ripples of leaf-made ships will reach me one day, adrift. What does water move? What does it conduct? Words fluent on her lips, her eyes glinting black. I'll hold her as though her body is a raft made of bric-a-brac, and we'll be 2 swimmers welded again into the sun on the sea. Choose a well to bury me in, slow echoes and awake to make my bed, a sunken stone turret, a graft of moss, and from the upper world, a pebble tossed. The last poem in the collection is called, fittingly, Caboose, which when I wrote it, never occurred to me that it would be at the end of a collection. Caboose. On a night outside time, I heard wind chimes dimly ring, then rest, and a train accelerate like the rhythm of slow maracas gaining on a sad old Cuban song. I didn't know until the afternoon that there were no cabooses anymore, that the train, however long, carried on without its tail, a rattlesnake without its rattle. I guided it, born for me on Christmas morning, through shrubs of wrapping paper, down the steep grade of a wooden slide, past my mother's early morning rapture. No caboose where the conductor could discuss the matter with his pipe, display the flags, fuss with ticket stubs, empty the windsock of dust and rain, wave to the boys on their bicycle waiting at the junction for the unknown to stop and let them board. So I'd like to read a few recent poems. How are we doing time-wise? I said I'd, okay, I got a few more minutes. And my next collection probably will, hasn't, it's written and, but is now awaiting the deity of form to seize it. In the meantime, it's just discrete poems with some notions of what its direction is. I wanted to read this poem. It's called The Forgiveness Orchard, and it because I wanted to read it here because I knew I wouldn't have to explain what the word eidetic means. The Forgiveness Orchard. Concentrate on her hand and its freshness, the loin of its palm, the apple-scented fingers summoning back the slap that spread across your cheek, gathering it in their seams of heat, the way a magnet drags the metal shavings back that had once been part of it. Don't ask questions the hand can't answer. Focus on its form. Let the hand that stung you restore you to the maiden grass you started from, a believer again in the eidetic apple beyond your reach. Relaunch the immortal humming of the bees and let the sound swarm over you. Rewind the stem. Put the apple back on the tree. I don't know if anyone's noticed this, but Google has been advertising their search engines by talking about random facts and showing how Google can be used to reach the answer. And so I don't know whether I made this one up or I read it there. It's called An Armenian Winemaker in the Copper Age. His sandals were found pointing south out of the cave next to his drinking cup. The vines he'd staked tailed into the ravine where the river was sinewy over the rocks. Pooled water saved his quicksilver face for the occasional sun, reaching sun to radiate. Harvest by harvest, he'd watched himself perish in his son's dark eyes after leaves began to grow on trees and the first horses were tethered. If only the sun would ripen that gaze and make it light like the wine in his mouth, as sweet as one of God's 99 names. At dusk, father and son stood side by side without glancing sideways, and both wondered why all of the blackbirds gathered in the same flowering tree and how they could agree on which one was the richest. This is the next poem. It's a very short poem, but more and more I'm coming to think of it as an important poem for me. It's called Poem Without Words. The falling leaves do not make a poem unless they fall through you, from you. The brittle edges rasp against your chin. The sea is silent in their ribs. No rows of trees along the beach. A poem without words or sound. Three smokestacks press toward you through the haze. You know they're there to help you up. I didn't organize my papers that well, it seems. I wrote a poem based on a sculpture in our park, and it was a sculpture of the of Echo by a Spanish sculptor named Jaume Plensa, who's quite a well-known public art space sculptor. And the model for the sculpture was a 9-year-old girl who played in his Barcelona neighborhood. And this sculpture stayed there for 4 months. And the more I walked by it, 3, 4, 5 times a day, I looked at it. I was there when it was dismantled. I realized I'd fallen in love with this figure. And of course, it made me go back and read about the myth and read about the myth's portrayal in literature. And I found I couldn't stop writing about it. So I hope this doesn't try your patience, but this is a poem in 3 parts and the penultimate poem. This is called Echo. White as X-ray bone, she rises through the trees and stone as if she were sublime. As if she knew what this grace was, and she was only 9, framed between her errands and her games. Her nymph's body surges underground, not knowing yet what this buried love is for. Beneath, her neighbors play frisbee on the grass, and strangers take her photograph. The final sun pours into her sealed eyes and mouth, as though she were the saint of radiant stillness, who says this marble flesh is a prison stone, yet the mind flies with the confetti of birds, soars into the beliefs of summer. Silence succumbs to air, and the blossoms sail down, the clock tower's fretted hands notched against her ribs. Questions flood her blood, and darkness flee, and then she's gone, taken from our vanquished arms. She still speaks in the autumn leaves, in the furrowed bark, in the sing-song of the children's swings. Part 2 is called Narcissus Wandering. From town to town, he carried his own sheets and towels, like dressings for a wound only he could see. In one pocket, he kept a book of common praise, in the other, an apple and a camping knife. He knew how cruel neglect could be in the early mind, and what that hunger was like in the afternoon, especially in a place without a bank or a grocery store. The girl who loved him was only a child, having another tantrum. Her calling haunted him from lake to lake. What refreshment could he bring? What meal to share? With his fingers, he'd comb her fallen hair if only she'd stay quiet. The air clotted, and there was thunder, like an amateur moving furniture across an upstairs room before the rain began to smear his golden face. Rarely was a sign this clear in the water's overlapping lines. He left with his valise and walking stick, the bones of his feet burning in his moccasins step by step. The pond, her lips, these flowers on the bank, would not dissolve his name. 3. Echo gone. She plays peekaboo in the scumbled leaves, in the arabesques of branches. She is absent from the dawn, the treetops, the spiral pathways. She hovers over me like a hologram, and I reach toward her when the light is perfectly tilted until her image falters and reappears. She is quicksilver I strain to fence in the thatch of my fingers, which falls away as I search for her shuttered eyes. She chances through me on a whim of wind and particle matter, in stop and go traffic, in open air leisure, like the lover the cat catches, fleeing on both sides of his eyes. She is my angel of stealth, hiding in the upper pasture, not a girl repeating a playground rhyme until her parched tongue collapses on the cloud's soft palate. Her quickness, her shadow leaves me panting behind her, cement-footed, as if I were the one who was made of stone, who could only love what was made of stone. Well, thanks for your patience and for coming. And thanks to St. John's and Dean Krause for having me. It's a great opportunity to read and wonderful to have people come out and listen to you. I just want to read the last poem called The Man with Many Pens. With one he wrote a number so beautiful, it lasted forever in the legends of numbers. With another, he described the martyr's feet as they marched past the weeping stones and cypresses watched by their fathers. He used one as a silver wand to lift a trout from its spawning bed to more fruitful waters and set it back down, its mouth facing upstream. He wrote, "Time has no other river but this one in us. No other use but this turn in us, from mountain lakes of late desires to confusions passed through with every gate open. Let's not say he didn't take us with him in the long current of his letters, his calligraphy and craft moving from port to port, his hand stopping near his heart, the hand that smudged and graced the page, asking, asking, his fingers a beggar's lucent black for the word that gave each of us away." Thank you.